Technology to the Fall 98 University Library Colloquia Series. And I'm very happy to be able to introduce you to a very good friend of mine who's going to launch the series for the fall. Her name is Maria Arlowski. The name that she wrote her book under is Miriam Winter. Miriam was born in Poland in the city of Łódź, known as Łódź in Poland, in 1933. She studied drama and theater in Poland. She is married. She has two sons. And the family came to this country in 1969. And in 1979, she came to Jackson, Michigan, where Maria and I became very good friends. Maria studied drama and theater in Poland. And when she came to Michigan, she was very active in local theater. She taught in Jackson Community College and she at other venues. And she also did a PhD in theater here at Michigan State University. She was born in 1933 in Poland. She last saw her parents and her brother at the age of 8. Her reality was no different than all the Jews in that time, that place. But every story is a unique world unto itself. She launched herself on a personal quest to recover her lost memory of childhood and to record that search. She recorded it in that book titled Trains that she's going to talk about and she's going to read to us from here. And she's going to tell her story in her own words. Thank you, Maria.
Can you hear me? On Memorial Day weekend, 1991, the first international gathering of Jewish children who survived the war in hiding united 1,600 hidden children and an equal number who responded but were unable to attend. The gathering was triggered by a film, a documentary entitled As If It Were Yesterday, by Miriam Abramowicz and Esther Hoffenberg. The film told the story of the Belgian Resistance Network, a group which saved more than 4,000 Jewish children during the war. A child survivor, Nicole David, saw the film and contacted Miriam Abramowicz, who remarked that she encountered other hidden children each time she had shown the film. That was the spark that triggered the gathering of 1,600 hidden children who came from 28 countries. I was among those who came to New York in 1991. Why did I go? To search for my brother, who was 3 years old when I left. To find other people whose experience paralleled mine. There, we exchanged stories about our hiding experience. We examined the guilt that continues to haunt many of us, the pain we felt at losing our families, our loneliness, our anger, and our confused, frightening, lost childhood. During the plenary sessions, we listened to panels entitled To Hide No More and The Psychological Impact of Being Hidden as a Child and What Motivated the Rescuers. The workshops, the core of the gathering, focused on issues that deeply affected us, such as I never said goodbye, lost childhood, forced to grow too quickly, fear of relationships. What have we done with our anger and fears? How do we tell our children of our losses and traumas? Who am I, a Catholic or a Jew? Where was God? And are our memories real? Among others. There, Among the hidden children, I found others with the same reactions, the same fears. I listened to people describing their pain and loss and separation and silence and learned about myself. I listened to the researchers and recognized myself. Quote, our daily existence was tied to two closely connected requirements, giving up our Jewish identity and silence. Giving up our identity meant playing a part, becoming someone else. The better we played the role, the safer we were. Sometimes we were so caught up in the new part that we actually forgot who we really were, said a noted sociologist and the child survivor, Nehama Tetz. In order to ensure survival, that's another quote, visible hidden children, the researchers now divide us, among other, to two groups. Those that were hidden in such a way that they were not seen by anyone. I have a friend, and I did not know about it for many years until her mother told me that when the war ended, Zosia, a Jewish girl from Poland who spent 3 years in a closet, didn't know how to walk. She was 11 when the war ended. But I still envied Zosia, although I could walk. I was one of those visible children, because after the war, Zosia's mother found Zosia. And no one found me because no one survived. So I'm returning to the quote. In order to ensure survival, visible hidden children were forced to lead double lives. To be visible meant to be constantly reminded of one's new identity. Children had to rehearse their stories. You are from the city and came to work on a farm where there's more food, for example, wrote a psychologist, Eva Fogelman. That first gathering in 1991 was followed by many others, the second in 1993 in Jerusalem, the next one in 1994 in Montreal. This year's gathering of the combined hidden children and child survivors groups will take place in mid-October in Washington, D.C. Next year's meeting will take place in Prague, where the chief rabbi is a former hidden child. There are now about 5,000 hidden children, former hidden children, that we know of. There are still some that we don't know. So all the numbers that I'm giving you are approximations. We know of about 70 groups around the world. We have regional organizations here in the United States. The Michigan meets once a month in West Bloomfield. In Poland, the Warsaw group has about 634 members. Those of you who heard me earlier here in April heard me saying 500. Each time before such an important meeting like today's, I call Renata Zeidman, who lives in Montreal, who is a survivor from Warsaw, who also was in a Warsaw ghetto as I did, and who is often traveling to Poland and is our informal liaison. She speaks with those people that meet with the survivors still in Poland. So I called her last week, and the number that I'm giving you today is, as of today, 634. We hope that to Prague many people will come next year. That group is very important. In that Warsaw and in other cities in Poland, there are small groups. In that group of former hidden children, child survivors that are still in Poland, are some people who did not admit that they were Jewish, but knew who they were, as I did know and did not admit. But most of them are those who knew nothing about their past. People who picked up a child lying on the floor, perhaps wrapped up in a pillowcase with a little note pinned up, which always gave the child's name, often chose not to tell him or her, and raised the child. So now old people with children and grandchildren learn for the first time from dying people, you know, you are not really my daughter. You are Jewish. Your name is Zosia Zamoyska or something. I'm just making up that one name. During the plenary sessions at the gathering of child survivors that I attended, we listened to historians, thinkers, writers, who told us that we must bear witness to the Holocaust. We, the hidden children, were urged by the prominent Jewish historian, Martin Gilbert, who said, "You are the last generation of survivors who can respond positively to the cry of the venerable Jewish historian Shimon Dubnov, who called out as he was about to be killed in Riga in 1941, Schreibt and verschreibt, write and record." We were reminded by Elie Wiesel that children were special targets singled out for destruction. About 1.5 million Jewish children were murdered during the war. Pre-war Poland had an estimated 1 million Jewish children. Of these children in Poland, from infancy to age 14, an estimated 5,000, or 0.5%, were alive at the end of the war. There were a few more. I am not listed on that list of 5,000 because I did not come out from hiding after the war. That and the realization as I came of age, old age, over 65, that we are the last witnesses was what prompted me to write my memoir, and I will read from the book. I will read from chapter 1 and from chapter 3, which quotes Polish text, and I give an English translation, but I would like you to hear the sounds as they sounded to a child and as they sound in original language. But I would like to end my preceding few remarks with a quote from a child survivor and Israeli writer Aharon Apfelberg, who, like me, was 8 when he went to hiding, and who reminded us in Jerusalem when he spoke to us that Nazi turned us into numbers and carved numbers on our bodies, and that we must rescue the suffering from the huge numbers and from anonymity, he said. And that's why I wrote my story. I am one of those hidden children who remained hidden long after the war. I was 8 years old when I went into hiding. I knew who I was, and yet I hid my Jewish identity. Until 1962, when I was 29 years old, I did not tell anyone who I was. I kept my false Christian name, Maria. My memoir of my hidden childhood is signed, and that's the first time I signed that name, Miriam Winter, as you would pronounce, and Winter, which means the same, the cold season, and that's why I remembered the name that my father gave me. From the very beginning, the first chapter titled The Name. How did your mother call you? Asked Romek. Marysia. I lied. My name in hiding was Marysia, but my real name was Miriam. Lies saved my life during the war, and I didn't stop lying when the war ended. So how did your mother call you? It was December of 1962, 17 years after the war had ended. How did she call you? Marysia. How did she call you when you were small? Marysia. When you cried and she whispered to calm you down? Marysia. How did she call you when you were out in the yard? My mother called me Mirka. They all called me Mirka. Until the fall of 1941, I was a daughter, a granddaughter, a sister, a niece, and we lived like a tightly knotted string of beads, always together. Then the string broke, and I wasn't called Mirka anymore. In Poland, if you walk on a sandy beach after a storm, you may find a small bit of amber, fossil resin of the prehistoric trees that were buried in the ground for millions of years. Its colors could vary from light yellow, like nasturtium in a village garden, to golden brown, like honey poured over a piece of dark bread. Amber is soft to the touch. It feels warm even on a cold day. Worn over a winter dress, amber beads evoke summer fields full of grains, like the fields in Styków. Pierced, strung together, small pieces of amber feel light around your neck. If you wear those beads, you will touch them often, and they will awaken your senses. Each bead is full of life. You can feel the past embedded in the beads. Sometimes a relic remains inside a bit of amber, a bug's wing, a piece of leaf, a splinter of a twig. These small pieces may tell about life as it was before the ice rolled over the prehistoric trees. For years, my own feelings lay dormant like a fossil insect inside an amber bead. Now, 50 years after the war ended, I want to uncover my past. I want to learn who I was. I want to know a girl called home by mother. I close my eyes and wait. I see a girl with long black braid, wearing a navy-colored dress with a sailor's collar, a sailor's hat, and white knee-high socks. I see two black buttons holding the narrow straps of my black patent leather shoes. I can't recall my mother's face, but I hear a voice calling, Mirka, Mirka. For years, I didn't speak about the war. People were killed. Parents watched their children slain. I survived. What was there to tell? Only the dead can tell. But when my older son, Daniel, went to school, his teacher asked me to meet with the students to tell them about my life. Were you even in a concentration camp? Asked a boy named Kevin. No, I said. Have you been very close to being killed? At once I said no. But later, at home, my memory returned. A memory of running scared. All of a sudden I recalled a woman screaming in a crowded church. Proszę księdza, ona nie dostała rozgrzeszenia! Father, she didn't receive absolution. I recalled my escape to a forest and the fear of being found out. Why didn't your parents try to hide your brother? Ashley asked. Her brother Eric is 7 years old. As any older sister would, Ashley feels protective of Eric as I felt when I played with Yuzho. My little brother, Yuzho, was only 3 years old when I left. Jewish boys were marked, I told Ashley. In Poland, only Jews were circumcised. Who would risk hiding a 3-year-old boy? I don't even know how he died. A boy in a green sweatshirt raised his hand. Did you try to find your brother after the war? I didn't search for my family until many years later. Why? I was still hiding after the war, and I was all alone, I replied. He didn't ask any more, but for me the questions continued. Why didn't I try to find my family after we parted in the fall of 1941? I left them in a heartbeat and my heart didn't stop pounding. After the war ended, my past was closed like an old valise. I didn't have to hide anymore, but I remained in hiding. I didn't admit that I was Jewish. I wore my mask well and smiled often. I spent many nights and days riding trains. From chapter 3, The Trains. And I read fragments of chapters, not through. I was on a train to Rabka when I first heard about the war. Wojna was the word I heard. I was on a train and people were talking about the war. Wojna. This is the chapter that will have many Polish words and expressions that I will read in original. I was 4 years old and this was the first train ride that I remember. I was still weak after a bad case of measles. A doctor advised a short stay in a sanatorium. Rabka in the mountains of Tatra was the one he suggested, so mother and I boarded the train and went to Rabka. I remember letters from my father that were sent to me from Łódź. He printed large block letters on small pieces of paper. My letters to father were also printed in large letters on small pieces of paper. I tore a page from a notebook and wrote, Kochany tatusiu, dear father, in large block letters. I loved my father. He was short, bold, funny, and fast as a bullet. When he wrote back, it was again in pencil, in large print, on small pieces of paper. In my memory, images of those letters, large print, in pencil, on small pieces of paper, merge with another piece of paper with block letters that he handed to me on our final goodbye 4 years later. I remember those letters from before the war, for there were no other letters from any member of my family. Never. In Rabka, I missed seeing father, who remained in Łódź to take care of his store. I missed our nightly readings. Słoni Trombalski, Tranki, the Elephant, by Julian Tuwim, was my favorite poem. Each time that father would read about this elephant who kept forgetting that his name was Tomasz, I would say in jest, his name was Tobiasz, and I would look for approval into my father's eyes. His name was Tobiasz, and that's how we pronounce what you pronounce as Tobias, Tobiasz, so it rhymed. His name was Tobiasz, and he never failed to acknowledge my childish wit. And that's why I was almost sure I knew my father's name when the war ended. Father taught me how to recite another poem by Tuwim, Locomotive, in which Tuwim used Polish onomatopoeic words like buch, uch, puff, oof, and rhythmic repetitions to express the sounds of a steam engine. These were words easy for a child to say, words expressing movements of a train from the first hiss of a steam engine to the full speed of a train in motion. I remember reciting Locomotive in the Warsaw Ghetto. My body and voice moved with the train. Najpierw powoli, jak żółw, ociężale ruszyła maszyna po szynach o spale, arms forward and back like the piston rods. Slow motion at first, then speed up the pace, legs stepping into the gradual increasing rhythm of train wheels on the track. To takto, to takto, to takto, to tak. Gear up, step on it, haste and hurry, rush under full steam. Rapid speed, double quick, flee at full speed, like the wind, race, steer, dash, flee, przez góry, przez tunel, przez pola, przez las. The Polish word for forest is las. And I hid in a forest after my life derailed like a crashing train. I came to my first hiding place on a train. Other trains rolled their wheels and I survived by a roll of a dice, pure random luck, a life saved by chance, punctuated by train stops, hitting the metal tracks, rhythmically caboose, choo-choo-cham, ta-ta-ta, ta-ta-ta, ta-ta-ta. My life was saved through a chance meeting of two strangers on a train. One steam engine stopped at a platform in Kielce, where Marilla boarded a train and met Cesia. If Marilla had gone to another compartment, I would have been killed. I survived, but I can't recall my mother's face, although I do remember the train that took me away. When the war ends, read newspapers, said father. We have family abroad, maybe someone will be looking for you. He didn't say, I will look for you after the war. He did not have such hope. Until that evening, my parents were looking for ways to escape. They were young and resourceful. They left Łódź on time. They even left the Warsaw Ghetto before it was completely sealed off. They still had some money, some jewelry hidden, and some large pieces of good English wool from their store in Łódź. But in the fall of 1941, the slaughter of Jews in Poland was put into motion in a well-organized way. There was no place to hide. No way to escape. My parents lost hope. One evening in November, a woman came to visit and mother sent me outside. I didn't know that it was Cesia. She was blonde and she looked like a Polish woman. I didn't know that she was Jewish. I remember my father teaching me how to make the sign of the cross. He sat me across from himself at the kitchen table. He gave me a piece of paper on which the Lord's Prayer was written in pencil in large block letters. He told me that from now on my name was Marysia Kowalska. He ordered me to call every woman I would be with Mama and every man Tata and never to admit that I was Jewish. Riding away from my family in a horse-drawn buggy with a tall blonde woman I didn't know and with a boy of 14 named Stefan, I wasn't crying. I sat deep in my seat reading by the moonlight. On small pieces of paper were words penciled in large block letters. I was memorizing the Our Father. My father, a religious Jew, gave me this Christian prayer to memorize as quickly as I could and to repeat in front of anyone who might look at me. Our parting seemed uneventful. All I can recall are rushed actions, short instructions. No hugs, no crying, no kissing. What did I say to my little brother, Yuzhyo? What did grandmother, Shaina? Where did grandmother, Shaina, stand at the time of my departure? Where was grandfather, Shimon? Where was mother? What did she say? How did she look? Did she touch me? Nothing. From that right away, I remember nothing more except a red scarf tied around my neck. I kept my prayer note, repeating it again and again, quickly becoming an obedient girl who would memorize her new prayer and forget the face of her mother. Years later, in 1980, when after finding Cesia in 1972, I met her for the first time in Israel in 1980. Years later, Cesia told me how my mother begged her to take me away. Until then, I didn't know. I was 8 years old. I didn't know that we were parting. I didn't realize that it was forever. I didn't know what I left and why. Fifty years later, the sound of a pile driver reminded me of trains. I was in Yad Vashem with other child survivors attending the gathering of hidden children. I learned that the Jews from Ozharuv were taken to the death camp in Treblinka. During a memorial service at the Hall of Remembrance, my body pressed against the black, raw iron rail, I let my tears fall. We stood looking into the eternal light burning like a crematorium. We looked down on a floor inscribed with the names of the 22 largest Nazi concentration and death camps. Treblinka was below on my right, 9 block letters on a gray mosaic floor. From the Hall of Remembrance, we went to the Valley of the Communities. Names of cities and towns, villages and shtetls were chiseled into the stone. I noticed Rzeszów high on the wall, Kolbuszowa, Raniżów, Radom, Szydłowiec, Kielce, Opatów, and then I found Ozharów, 4 from the bottom on another wall. Ozharov was a temporary stay between the Warsaw Ghetto and my hiding places. Ozharov was the last place I was with my parents. I touched Ozharov. The sun-based stones returned my touch. One man said, "I don't even know my name." I told him, if my brother had survived, he wouldn't know his name either. Would you know how he looked? No, I wouldn't. This meeting with a man who doesn't know his name still lingers in my heart. Like me, he had many false names. Like me, he survived alone. I am still searching, but there are no traces. I have often wondered why I survived. I'm all that's left of the families of Winter and Korn. If I hadn't lived, there wouldn't be a soul to say that they even existed. I am their witness. From the epilogue. The taste of honey still lingers in my mouth as I take my red shovel to clean the driveway. It is early morning in winter 1996. Outside, the day starts bright and crisp. Tree branches, leafless, almost black, contrast with the white, snow-covered garden. Everything is clear, well-defined, black and white. No gray. In less than 2 hours, I will tell my story. Again, some questions I'll answer with, I don't know. Like the one about Marilla's motives for saving my life. Driving to Ann Arbor, just a 40-mile stretch on Interstate 94, I think about those gray, unanswered questions. When I left Poland at age 36 in 1969, I didn't think that I'd be able to function in another language. But my two sons, David, who was born in Boston in 1970, and his older brother, Daniel, who left Poland at 4, taught me English while I worked in a store and took classes at night. Later, I taught acting to American students. I directed Antigone and Ondine and Peer Gynt in an American college. Then I went back to school. At 59, in 1992, I earned a PhD in theater from Michigan State University. But my trip to Ann Arbor isn't about theater. Today I will tell my story to students at the University of Michigan. Maybe that's why I survived, to reclaim the dead from the death of non-remembrance. Walk with me by a railroad track, step by step, back to a last childish game, tough the night, ride the train. Train your eye, tear by tear, to see the night, to hear steps on the track, cries unheard, step on the rail. This train won't come back. Inside, a large auditorium is filled with students. They are 19 and 20 and 21. I stand in front of the map of Poland responding to their questions. "Maybe not guilt," says an older man sitting on my left, somewhere in the middle of this large auditorium, when I say that I feel guilty for surviving. He hears my foreign accent, and he wants to help me find the right word. But that's how I feel each time I see a photo of a child, like usual, in front of barbed wire, guilty for being spared when others were killed, guilty for surviving when my family didn't. I listen to the sound of the word guilt, and I can touch its slimy pulp. It holds like glue. Afterwards, in my parka, boots, and fuzzy woolen gloves, I go for a walk. Wind makes my cheeks tingle. The road slopes uphill and my feet begin to ache. I stop, stretch my hamstrings, and continue uphill. Now the questions blow in the wind. Why didn't I search for my family? The snow falls on my face, soft and clean. Young snow, just fallen, unspoiled, fresh and receptive. It smells like hope and trust. What happened to my feeling of trust? Why did I hide my Jewish identity after the danger was over? I hear those questions in the snow under my feet as I walk back toward my car. I press my boot into the snow, and the snow shapes around the sole. It's give and take. I squeeze a handful of snow. It takes the shape of my fingers. Why did I stay so long with Marilla and Rishu? That question is tangible, like the onion that I brought to the rehearsal when I directed Ibsen's Peer Gynt. It smells like an onion, but my tears are real. Peer Gynt ran away. Why did I stay? I look at that question. I bring it to my nose and sniff like a dog. I'm still in the middle of the campus. I pick up more snow and squeeze it in my palm. Now, even that handful of snow has a stinking smell. Do you believe in God? Asked my roommate when we sat together for Shabbat service during the gathering of child survivors in Montreal in 1994. I believe in Jews praying together, I said. I don't know whether God exists, but even if he doesn't, he is here, sitting among survivors who came from all over the world. I felt his presence. God was with us, davening, bending his knees, praying with the former hidden children of whom only so few survived. I looked at old people around me, but I only saw children trying to hide, Jewish boys and girls running scared, looking for shelter that so few found. In this clean smelling room where we gathered to pray, I smelled the ashes. I prayed that God did too. It was only much later, after arriving in the United States, that I returned to my Jewish religion. In the fall of 1969, still in Rome, awaiting permission to enter the United States, we went to an old Sephardic synagogue. It was Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Families stood together praying. Each group was covered with a talis, the Jewish prayer shawl. I looked at one family. In the center stood a tall man, covered with a talis, spreading his arms over each member of his large family as if protecting his flock. The fringes of his talis rested on the heads of two little girls at both ends of the sequence, so that his whole family seemed covered. The talis, like a tent roof, made me feel safe. I felt that I had returned to my own tent. I came back under the roof of my tent, and the floor of the synagogue was my ancient land, covered with tents. I could remember that it was home. It was fall. I knew there would be other winters. I also knew there would be a talis that would cover me, safe, home. These are the houses I've known, the towns I remember, the tables I've moved among. One room is lost forever. A small room in the outskirts of town, a rented room in someone else's house in a strange town with a strange sounding name, Ožarov. My family was transient there. It was a step on a flight of stairs. Yet it was a quiet room, tranquil, despite the fears that were whispered by adults, whispered in foreign tongues, to feign tranquility, to make children feel safe. In the center of the room was a small wooden table. Around that table, four people sat. But I cannot see them anymore. I can hear them chant. I don't know the tune. Their heads covered, father and grandfather, their eyes locked. A too large hat on Yuzhou's tiny head. A room as small as a planet Earth dropped from God's hold.
Maria will be glad to respond to them. If anyone wants to say anything, any comments? Yes.
How were you able to
Would you like for me to repeat the question? The question was, how was Maria able, when she became older, to admit to herself that she was Jewish, to to secure her identity?
On August 26, I was in Chicago reading at Borders, in one of the Chicago suburbs. And there I've met a woman a little bit over 4 weeks younger than I am. And her mother found her after the war. And she read my book when she came. And she said that she cannot remember anything. The question was how I could remember. I did and I didn't. I thought and I thought not. I gave you some mnemonic hooks that helped me because of the poetry, that it happened that Tomasz rhymed with Tobiasz and my lips and my tongue remembered even if the body didn't. And because it happened that winter means the same as winter, that I remembered that someone was telling, remember your name is, means the cold season. So I thought I did, and I thought I didn't. And I wasn't sure for a very, very long time, even if I remembered correctly my names, until before we left Poland, in 1969, in January of 1969, I found my birth certificate. It was easy to find it. Łódź, the city where I was born, was not burned or ruined during the war. The acts are there. That's where I was registered, where I was born, when I was born. I came back to Łódź in 1959 when I was open, as you are, at your age, I had all the time in the world. I studied for 4 years in theater school in Łódź. I walked the streets. As it happened, the theater school in a former villa of a rich German manufacturer is not far away from Plac Wolności. The theater school is on Gdańska 32, Gdańsk Street number 32. It's a walking distance, very close to Plac Wolności, which is the Liberty Plaza, which was the place where my parents kept told me, if you ever get lost, remember that place here. And I could recall it if I wanted. And from the apartment building where I lived before the war. But I never walked. As a child, that grown woman in my mid-20s, who transformed her empathy and her heart and soul and mind to a tiger or a grieving father or a child who broke his toy or whatever part I acted in during those years. Never, that grown woman never transformed and never reached out to the time when she was complete. And I don't know why. That's why I had to write. Because I'm sure that there are others. I was lucky I survived. I was also lucky that finally those people who kept me captive at 15 let me go. So I went across the country. And it turned out that there were places where I could have gone after the war, had I known. And for 3 more years, I lived as a, among other orphans, or half orphans, because other people, those were Polish orphanages, so there were people who lost someone during the war, or had families who were unable to help them, to raise them. I was the only one who had no one. So although I displayed my first communion photo in every room where I came as a shield for anyone who would look to know that I'm not Jewish, that I'm Christian, people were guessing, because how come no one who knows you from before the war, no neighbors, no friends, no people that played soccer with your father or kept sewing with your mother? No one? Completely no one? At 15? So people were guessing. And I guess that such lives as mine, not described, were. So I wrote for those people also. My dear friend, a sensitive person and a wonderful professional, a trained psychologist with a master's degree in psychology, who asked that question, also asked me a question in Jerusalem. And that was when it occurred to me that I never thought about those things. She said, we talked for a long time, and then she said, where did you change? How did you wash? When I told her that I took the train across, and then in the morning I left the suitcase in the place and left to enroll to school, I don't know what I wore. I don't remember changing. That woman that asked me that question doesn't remember changing or food or anything that our senses remember. If you would kindly come to the microphone, other people would be
interested. Thanks very much for your story. This is a kind of follow-up to that question. It has to do with the difficulty of working through a period in which one is forced to lie I'm sure you're familiar with the book Wartime Lies by Louis Begley, which he talks about the same kind of experience you've described, though for a male child, and struggles with his ability to then break out of those lies and begin to tell the truth. Was that an issue for you?
Thank you for asking that question and for mentioning that wonderful book. It was difficult for me. My husband is not a Jew, and he met me because a mutual friend told him about me. He's also short. She said, you should meet her, okay? So he came to meet me, and shortly after, and he suspected that I'm Jewish. That woman, my girlfriend from the university, also suspected that I'm Jewish, and she also told him she has no documents. In Poland, you had to have, it was called Dowód Osobisty, a little booklet where it was written, and each time I would move from one place and someone would start questioning, why don't you? And that one was made for me in the orphanage, but I kept losing them. So maybe some of you, of professionals that are here, would guess why I kept losing my documents that were really required. That scene with which I opened my book, How Did Your Mother Call You?, opened me. It was much longer. My husband is a terribly stubborn man, and he, if I wouldn't finally admit after many hours, he would talk for a year until finally I would say it. So yes, I did say it. And he lived in Łódź. I at that time lived in Warsaw. And he had many Jewish friends. He invited me to, he invited me to his friend's house. And he brought me there, and he said at the door, "Ona jest Żydówka." She's Jewish. And I felt scared immediately. Even before, and that was an old Jewish woman to whom he said it. And I wanted to run. Earlier, that night, because we were at his mother's house in that December, when his mother invited me for Christmas there. And he said to his mother, "Kochaj ją, ona jest Żydówka." Love her, she's Jewish. Which was quite illogical because his mother is very, she died recently, she was a deeply believing Catholic, a wonderful woman, but he just had to say both things at once so that the walls will be raised or broken down and the communication will be normal. And again, I wanted to run away. His mother's house, and I write about it in the book, stands by woods. We walked from the train station about 3 kilometers through the snow, and finally, afar, first I saw the dark contours of woods, and then my husband said, pointing to the light, "There is our hut, tam jest nasza chatka." There is our little hut or small house or whatever. And again, I wanted to run away. And then each time I was fearful, after my first older son, Daniel, was born, I always felt that he will survive because he can hide at Babunia, grandmother's house. He can be in hiding there. He was born in 1964. The heart and the soul did not acknowledge. And it still didn't, and it still doesn't. Once a month we meet in West Bloomfield, and I prefer to drive alone, and I sit in my little car and I drive fast there. On the way back I drive very slowly, and I would stop the car to cry. And there are old people coming, and especially after the facts about Madeleine Albright came out. Some people who came to this country just after the war couldn't understand. They didn't even believe that she didn't know who she was, and she was four. Of course she didn't know. Of course her parents wouldn't tell her if they didn't want her to know. I have no doubts about it. I cannot witness for her, but I understand that. But I do empathize with her parents. They were in their 20s, and they chose not to tell her. Many people in our group kept saying, why didn't she? And then, in the middle of such statements, someone would say, but you know, when I try to say I'm Jewish in Slovakian, I can't. And that's a woman who also happened to be a psychologist and came here after the war and was even younger when the war ended. And in memoirs of hidden children, and I actually have quotes here written also from other books where a woman raised in France will say the same thing, that in French she cannot say it. In English she can. So this is a very long way to answer your question. I am still struggling, and I'm still trying to piece it together, and it was very painful. I had to write a personal essay when I applied to be admitted to Michigan State University. And the essay had to say about my life in connection with theater. And it happened that it started quite early. Those of you who already read the book, I saw a first wonderful performance. I did see theater before the war, the child's plays, but I saw a performance that deeply affected me in 1944, and I write about it. In order to write that essay, I had first to write that I don't recall my mother's face. And those 3 pages I left in another file in my computer and cried over it. And then after writing that, I was able to write a decent essay that let me come in together with another credits. But I could not just start writing anything personal without reaching to that source. And the process still goes on. So I think there is another book, definitely a long essay, because I now speak to groups and meet people who, like that woman, don't remember almost anything, can't recall any food. She survived in Wieliczka. This is a cave in a salt mine. Very famous, very beautiful. Tourists go there. And she went back to Poland. She was in Auschwitz, Oświęcim. She went there also. She went to the house. She touched it. She can't recall anything. So we know a lot about human heart. We still don't know everything. And we are learning.
Thank you very much, Maria. Maria has books here, if anybody's interested in reading her story. There are some for sale here. There are also some books that were signed that are at the MSU bookstore in the International Center. And there are also some books at Schuller's available here in Okemos. I'd like to beg your pardon? And yes, here at the library also. I want to thank you all for coming this afternoon.